Well, I realized that I was the person who was scheduled to give the talk 4 years ago around this time. I went back and looked in my notes, and on November 16, 2016, I gave the talk. And we all can probably remember how we all felt 4 years ago, different ones of us, different feelings perhaps, but kind of all in the same circumstance in our country, our last presidential election. And so I was wondering when I realized, oh, I'm giving the talk on November 11. I wondered whether I would be giving the same talk as I gave 4 years ago. And I realized, no, actually, I don't have to give the same talk. And I must confess, I'm happy about that. And yet, you know, the opportunities for anxiety and for distress continue no matter who gets elected to be president. You know, we're still working out, our country is still working out its process, and we have to make it through these different milestones of our electoral process. And then there's the large issues that were with us before and are with us now and will be with us probably for the rest of our lives. The climate change crisis, the systemic racism that we're all awakening to, our roles in trying to stop, trying to turn the ship around, trying to live a more wholesome and inclusive and kind life on our time on the planet. So, and then we have our individual particular complexities, right? Each of our lives. I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on for each of you beautiful people in your little Zoom windows there, but you know, I know that different ones of us have lots of different struggles at this time. So, you know, I, as a Zen priest and as a teacher, it's kind of interesting. Because when the times are kind of tumultuous and challenging, as they seem to be in 2020, it's not uncommon that people either individually or in groups will say something like, you know, well, how should I practice with this? Or, well, what does Zen have to say about the situation? Or what does Buddhism have to say about the situation? And actually, you know, my answer, and I have been giving some version of this answer for some time now, is actually our practice is the same, no matter what's going on. And whether, you know, you want to characterize it that, well, our practice is to embrace and sustain right conduct, to embrace and sustain all good, and to embrace and sustain all beings. That's what Zen, that's what Buddhism, that's what I have to say to the question, how should we practice with this? And whether we translate that as following the precepts, ethical conduct, practicing the paramitas, generosity and compassion, whatever of the fundamental teachings that feel most helpful and relevant to help us do all good and embrace and sustain all being. That's our practice, no matter what's going on. You know, and a few months ago, and everybody's like, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How's it going to turn out? I'm like, we're going to do the very same thing, no matter what happens. We're going to love each other, and we're going to take care of the earth, and we're going to, take care of the world. That's what we're going to do. So, in a way, I could say, you know, there it is. Good night. But of course, I'm not going to, because here we all are, and there's more to be said. So while that is true, I think that it's also can be extremely helpful to have what I would call guiding formulations, particular guidance, not just this more kind of general. We'll just love each other. We'll do all good, embrace and sustain all being. But particular formulations, for example, like the Four Noble Truths. I mean, that is one of the great beautiful all-time guiding formulations of all time. And certainly that's one of the, you know, core teachings of our way and all Buddhists. So, you know, in that regard, the question of how should I practice with this? What does Buddhism have to say about these times? You know, that guiding formulation will be, well, notice where there is suffering. Notice what part of that is being caused by grasping and clinging, you know, to stories, to delusion. First and the second noble truth. The third noble truth, what could be done to relieve this suffering? What could be done to release my grip on the story that I'm clinging to? Cessation, the third noble truth. And then the fourth of the eightfold path, what wholesome practice could I cultivate? What would be helpful here? Might it be looking at my attitude? Might it be looking at my speech, or my effort? So, you know, that's a kind of a nutshell version of the Four Noble Truths, which I would call a really helpful guiding formulation. It's a little bit more specific than, you know, do all good and love each other and take care of the earth. So I came upon a couple of, I found, very helpful formulations in the course of the book that we're reading, the group of us that meets on the first Tuesday of every month. We started with reading Larry Yang's book, Awakening Together, 2 years ago or 1 year ago. I don't remember when it was. We finished that book and then we began Ruth King's Mindful of Race. And she is a wonderful teacher from the Insight meditation tradition whose practice and teaching is informed by her experience as being an African-American lesbian great-grandmother. Is how she describes herself. Those are some of the conditions and situations in her life that affect how she offers her teaching. And she's created this beautiful, short, but very potent book, Mindful of Race, that we are studying together. Of course, anybody's welcome to join us on the first Tuesday of each month. And in the course of reading it, I found that there was one of her chapters that I just thought, this is such a helpful and relevant guiding formulation that I wanted to bring it forward to offer to you this evening and mix in some of Ruth's teachings with some of my own study in with regards to a particular formulation. Now, she talks about it in her book for dealing with racial distress, you know, because that's what is the subject of her book and that's the focus of her work. And yet, as we were talking about last night a little bit in our group, really some of the very same ways that we're learning to study and practice with regards to the suffering that is caused through racism and what she calls racial distress also really apply to any kind of distress. Whether it's being a target of oppression or aggression because of some other kind of diversity that you have, or just distress in general. So while it's specifically targeted and helpful for dealing with racial distress, I think that it's also her formulation that I'm going to share with you would be helpful for any kind of distress. Oh, you know what? I want to read you something. And I said, page 9, and the book is in the living room. So you have to just sit here and look at each other for a moment while I go and get the book. Much quicker than having to drive across town. So, some of the kinds of questions that initially inspired her to come up with the program and the method, the teachings that she developed in this book were questions. And perhaps some of you have questions like this. How do I work with my thoughts, fears, and beliefs in ways that nurture the dignity of all races? How do I comfort my own raging heart in a sea of racial ignorance and violence? How can my actions reflect the world I want to live in and leave to future generations? How do I advocate for racial justice without causing harm and hate internally and externally? And again, I would invite you to substitute, really, if there's any particular kind of, whether it's a social justice or whether it's something in your own life that you're seeking to have some insight about, that you could consider that these questions are also inclusive of other aspects of our life, in addition to racial justice and racial distress. So she begins by talking about how we often feel a soreness and a tenderness and a vulnerability from the habitual ways that we bump up against the rough edges of racial distress. We bump up against these kinds of distress in the world, and they're rough edges, and we feel a sense of soreness, tenderness, and vulnerability, and it's easy to be overwhelmed, which in a way you could think of as a statement of the first noble truth, right? There is suffering. We experience this suffering. And even though the feelings, and she uses this very interesting term, she says, even though the feelings may be difficult to metabolize, it is possible to do so. And at the end of this talk I'm giving, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about what that means, metabolizing feelings. You know, essentially it's, she calls it investigating the unfinished business of the heart through the body. That we have these emotions and that we can learn how to take the emotions in into the body. This is not dissimilar to what I was talking about last time I was here. This way that we the physiology of the present was what I talked about last time. So even though it can feel difficult to take in these emotions and actually metabolize them and settle into the reality of them in our bodies, our thoughts and feelings are not permanent states. And one of the things that can make it seem so difficult is we get worried that it's always going to be this way and it's never going to change and this feeling is going to last forever. And in a way, that can be part of the, I know in my own life when I was struggling with depression, that was part of the cycle, the downward spiral. Oh no, it's always going to be this way. It's never going to change, right? And then we start getting frantic and anxious. So our practice offers us some ways to consider that is not true. It isn't always going to be like this. And we can use our practice. Now she calls it mindfulness because she's in the Vipassana tradition. In our tradition, we sit zazen, but it is possible through our sitting and through stilling and through slowing down and actually investigating our experiences with care and attention that we can begin to learn how to acknowledge and touch where we get stuck and then discover what supports us letting go. And again, there it is, the three of the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering. This is where I'm stuck. This is what can support me letting go. What's happening? You know, where are you gripped? And a beautiful term that Ruth King uses, how can you care for the pain that you are in at this moment? How can we care for this pain or this suffering? So she invites us to look at the three marks of existence as one of the kinds of structures for our inquiry and our insight that we can look at. And the three marks of existence comes all the way from the Buddha, three aspects of life. One is anicca, or impermanence, anatta, or non-self, and dukkha, or dissatisfactoriness, often translated as suffering, but it also could be thought of as unsatisfactoriness, right? So impermanence, non-self, and unsatisfactoriness, that these are actually really potent natural laws that offer insight into what can, if we start paying attention to these things and noticing, where are we actually causing more distress and what would support our release from distress? And by looking at these three areas, that can really, really help with releasing some of our distress. So this is the part that really made me excited, that I really wanted to bring this to you today, because she says the way she talks about those three marks is her mantra. She says, life is not personal, permanent, or perfect. Life is not personal, permanent, or perfect. And she's suggesting that when we can actually use those as frameworks for inquiry, it can really, really help to loosen things up and help us feel some ease and relief in our suffering. So let's go and look at each of those a little bit more closely. So the anatta, it's not personal. You know, the teaching of anatta is there is no enduring self. We are a series of changing processes that arise and pass away. And who we are, who we call ourselves, emerges out of causes and conditions. So this is a core teaching that shows up certainly very strongly in our Zen tradition. And she suggests that one of the ways that this can really help with the racial distress is to consider that in and of itself, race is not personal, nor is it a problem. The problem is how we perceive each other racially. The problem is what society projects onto particular racial groups, and how we relate to race as if it was solid and personal. So a question that she suggests that we could use if we're struggling with something that we're feeling like we're really making it personal is, are you making it personal rather than opening to realize this is part of the human experience? How many people before you have felt this way? It's not you as a single individual little being. You're part of a big set of causes and conditions. We're all part of a big set of causes and conditions. And if we can release our grasping to the personal part of it and breathe into, you know, this is arising and passing away, and these constructs that we project on each other are not really solid. The suffering is because people make them solid. You know, Black people are this way. White people are that way. You know, Japanese people are this way. Whereas, you know, I mean, even in the election, you know, we had a really good example where people were talking about, you know, the Latino vote, like it was this one thing. And then lo and behold, they found out when they started to look at all of the different ways that all of the different communities that are glommed onto this one category of Latino have all sorts of different needs and interests and political persuasions. It's not one thing. So, you know, there's so many ways that we do this to each other, not just in the racial context, but if we can release a little bit of that sense of the personal and open more to the human part, and then recognize in terms of not permanent, it is always changing. You know, the ideas and the constructs that create the suffering of racism are because people get these fixed ideas about each other and then they pass them on to their children. And we're really, that there's no room for any evolution or any change. So again, a way to relieve suffering by meditating on impermanence and that things are not permanent is to really allow for change to happen. Change your mind. engage with other people and recognize that their minds could change. Circumstances change. You know, we try to stop the river. We try to hold on to our fixed ideas and our fixed notions for safety, to protect ourselves. And yet it's really, it's such a source of suffering, because what we're trying to do is stop a river that is inherently and always going to be flowing and is always going to be changing. There's going to be an endless disturbance that's going on that we try to fixate and hold on to. So to meditate, to release our suffering about trying to make things permanent and fixed, and to relax into impermanence, is another way that we can practice with relieving our suffering. And then the third one, good old dukkha, you know, unsatisfactoriness. You know, our unsatisfactoriness is because we want the situation to be different than it is. I don't like this. I want it to be different. It should be different. It shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be this way. You shouldn't be that way. That's the heart of dukkha. That's that wheel jangling in the axle. That's what dukkha means. It means a wheel out of alignment in the axle. And so we can imagine we're on this wagon and we're going along and it's like, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work because we're not satisfied. It shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't be this way. You know, we want everything to be perfect according to our standards, our views. And then we get agitated if it's not, and maybe even aggressive, and try to change the situation, change other people so that we can be more comfortable in what we think is right. So a big, big part of surrendering to working with that life is not perfect, that it's always going to be imperfect, is to be willing to learn how to be, how to accept what is, to completely accept what is, things as they are, not as we are imagining that they should be. Now, of course, the question always comes up here. That doesn't mean not taking action on things that we need to act on. It doesn't mean being passive. It doesn't mean being complacent. It doesn't mean bypassing. It doesn't mean masking or glossing over injustice. No, not at all. Of course, we do those things. But the position from which we do those things is that in this moment, I accept reality as it is. That's the liberation. And then the idea of then whatever action I do take is going to be more grounded, and is not going to be as reactive, and is not going to be as defensive, and is not going to be coming out of this fixed notion of how things should be. There's more space. It's a more spacious place to act from. So that was the first guiding formulation that I thought was really pretty cool. Was to really to take these three marks and to recognize and to say it as the mantra of life is not personal, permanent, or perfect. And then the second one that I thought was also helpful that she didn't formulate was, she said it's actually a 25 years they've been using this in the Vipassana tradition. A woman called Michelle McDonald apparently first generated it. Is, and this goes back to that thing I was talking about in the beginning about how I lost it where it was, but it was the thing about metabolizing. And I was saying how, you know, things can feel really overwhelming. And it can seem really hard to actually metabolize them, but we can. The metabolizing, taking, being present with what is, and then taking it in and working with it in the body. There's a little acronym that this person, Michelle McDonald, created called RAIN, R-A-I-N. And this comes later in Ruth King's book, but I thought it would be really good to put in as part of what I'm offering to you as ways to help liberate our suffering. RAIN, R is recognizing, this is a little formula, recognizing what is happening as the first step, noticing what's happening in my body, what's happening in my heart, what is my emotional state, allowing ourselves to short circuit the mental proliferation, which actually has a term in Sanskrit. It's called papancha. There's so many great terms in this tradition, that the act of mental perseveration as a source of suffering, papancha, when we ground ourselves into what is actually happening right now in our bodies, in our hearts, in our emotions, we're short circuiting that upward rising spinning tendency that we have, and we're connecting with our direct experience. So that would be the first step, recognizing what is happening, what is true. And in Ruth's book, she has like a whole chapter about this, and she has several pages for each of these, with really, really beautiful and helpful questions and kind of guided practices. So again, if you're relating to what I'm saying and you'd like more, I recommend that you check out her book, Mindful of Race, Ruth King. And this is one of the later chapters. So recognize what is happening. The A in RAIN, allow the unfolding moment to be known without interference, judgment, interpretation, resistance. And this is not about condoning. It's not like, oh, this person is doing this really bad thing. It's not like I'm allowing them to keep doing that bad thing to me. It's that in my own mind and body, which is the place where I'm suffering, I recognize what this is, and I'm actually allowing what is true to be known in my mind and my body. I'm giving space to the energetic play of the distress, making space for this tension, for this anger, for this fear, for this hopelessness, making space for it to breathe and exist and be known and be seen and be touched, rather than no, 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 go away, or shut down, or worked up in a unwholesome agitation state, relaxing, turning towards it, allowing. And then the I is investigate. And maybe at first we just recognize and allow. If we're very traumatized or worked up, investigation isn't so easy. But maybe once our system starts calming down a bit, or the system of the other, if you're doing this and practicing with a friend or a person who's come to you needing some assistance, investigate. And this is, again, this would be maybe the third noble truth, you know, the second and the third, you know, how am I relating to what is happening? You know, are there any patterns or beliefs that are activated in me, or that I'm struggling with? Being curious about our views and how our views live in our bodies. And a few of the examples that she gave for, it's for allow. Let me go back. I forgot to note this. Yeah. So some of what allowing might sound like. Okay. Oh, this is hard. Ah, I see why I'm angry. So this is what confusion feels like. Somebody told me they went to Roshi Joan Halifax's election night meditation, and that was one of the things that she was encouraging people to practice with is, you know, oh, this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like to not know. You know, this is what confusion can feel like. Oh, this hurts. That's allowing. So then the investigation would be the curiosity about what is about our views. And then the last one, N, would be nurture, which is how do I care for this distress? So this is a different approach from kind of going up into psychology or going too far out into you know, I mean, it's beautiful in our spiritual traditions that we can go outside of ourselves go to, you know, the vows and go to nature. And, but sometimes we have to get kind of go down and we have to go down and we have to go in and we have to really, go inside. You know, the subtitle of her book is Transforming Racism from the Inside Out. You know, there is a part that's about outside in and there's a part that's about inside out. So, these were some of the, a couple of, helpful guiding formulations that I have been, studying this last week and that I wanted to offer to you. And maybe after we have announcements, if you would like to stick around and talk more about any of what I've been bringing up, any questions or, experiences you've been having about, getting in touch with your own, situations and what do you find helps you to, become aware of and to relieve suffering in this tumultuous time, be happy to stick around and do that with you. So at this point, what I'll do is just chant one time through our vows, and then I'll turn over the announcements to somebody who, like maybe like Patrick, because Patrick knows everything about things. So thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your attention. I hope that some of my words and Ruth King's words and Michelle Rain Creator's words and the Buddha's words can offer you some little tidbits and nibbles of sustenance and support in this time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.